I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Former Fox and Friends co-host Gretchen Carlson surprised a lot of people when she accused her boss, Roger Ailes, of years of sexual harassment and creating a hostile work environment when she reportedly refused his advances. Her contract was not renewed, and in July, she filed a lawsuit. More than 20 women have since accused Ailes of sexual harassment, some alleging incidents going back decades. Ailes resigned as Fox News chairman a few weeks after the suit was filed. More recently, Donald Trump defended Ailes and, when asked in an interview what his daughter should do if she were harassed at work, replied, "I would like to think she'd find another career or another company if that was the case." All of this has put sexual harassment back in the spotlight. We begin with Jim Rutenberg, media columnist for the New York Times, who's been covering the Fox story. And Jim, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great. Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. And let's begin with Gretchen Carlson and her lawsuit. What does she allege in this lawsuit?
Well, she alleged basically there was a serious charge, was a kind of borderline quid pro quo proposal, where she had had some complaints about promotion and her own kind of time slot, and she says that that Mr. Ailes had said to her, you know, if we had basically been sleeping together, both our lives would be easier. You know, so it was a pattern that she alleged that he denied. It looked like he was going to gut it out, and then the floodgates opened.
Well, and just to get this quote out there, I'm sure people have seen it. He allegedly said, according to Gretchen Carlson, "You'd be good and better, and I'd be good and better if we had sex." Is that what you're referring to, Jim?
That's the exact quote, yeah.
And then she talks go ahead.
Well, right, but that's basically, she's alleging there's a quid pro quo, which is basically as serious as it can get. He's denied the charge, but.
And she also talks about a hostile work environment. What are some of the details on that? What is she saying here?
You know, I think that, and these are complaints that we've seen now kind of widely, and it's an environment where, you know, she herself would sit on the set of Fox and Friends, and there would be comments from her hosts about always about appearance, her own appearance, you know, jokes about a woman's proper place. In one case, Gretchen Carlson actually stood up and left the set. So, you know, which at the time seemed kind of ha-ha funny, but clearly these were rankling her, and now we know much more about how much they were rankling her. And the other women at the network, and we've spoke to many of them ourselves, had similar complaints.
Well, you spoke to a number of women. How many have actually accused Roger Ailes of some form of sexual harassment?
Well, we're hearing, you know, I think we last reported more than 20. That number apparently is ticking up, and there's an internal 21st Century Fox investigation that's continuing, and interviews are continuing. And, you know, I think the question for some women is this investigation real? Is it serious? Because one risks a lot stepping forward, unfortunately, and still even in these times. But 21st Century Fox is assuring them that they will go wherever the complaints lead.
Were these women on record? Were they talking to you off the record?
Not a lot are speaking on the record yet. Even the biggest star at Fox, Megyn Kelly, who has told investigators that she had her own sexual harassment experience with Mr. Ailes, has not spoken publicly. We spoke to one former Fox correspondent, Rudy Bakhtiar, who told us that basically she broke her own settlement agreement with Fox by saying, "Look, I have to speak out." She was harassed by someone who was coming in to be her superior. His name was Eric Wilson.
Brian Wilson.
And Brian Wilson, who's a former Fox personality, he's denied it too. But she was talking about someone else, but her point was that there was a widespread environment and she was willing to risk violating the terms of a settlement agreement for which she was paid. So now there was another woman who stepped forward in New York Magazine, Laura Loon, a former booker, who alleges a 20-year relationship with Mr. Ailes, again, which he denies, that was abusive. And this one was critical to Fox's future because what she said was that certain people in the hierarchy of Fox News who remain in their jobs were kind of facilitating Mr. Ailes' relationship with her by providing resources and finally by cutting her a settlement. At least the most important figure in that is a gentleman named Bill Shine, who is now kind of helping to run the network, who's basically, he hasn't spoken publicly about this, but associates tell us, and at some point I'm assuming I'll have to speak about it publicly, that he was unwitting. He was being used, and he didn't know it.
And she, of course, paid a really handsome salary, I have to say. Now, what was the settlement that she had with Fox?
It was $3.15 million. Ailes still denying it. Basically, the way that the story goes is that Mr. Ailes denied this to his lawyer, Diane Brandy at Fox, but still recommended they cut a generous settlement, which is definitely an issue, as we understand it, that the internal investigation of the company will have to sort through, because it puts what was a lawyer's role in that. Again, she's a high up person at the network, and she's yet to speak publicly about it.
This Rudy Bakhtiar, and you have a pretty long story about her, what she, again, alleges and what happened to her. Can you fill us in on some of that?
Well, Rudy was basically friends with Brian Wilson. He was a Fox on-air talent, but he was coming in as a potential bureau chief. As she tells the story, she wanted to have a full-time job in the Washington Bureau, and he was implying that, if he got in place, he would take care of that, but then he followed that up in person with a proposal that they have a sexual relationship. According to her complaint, when she finally really shut him down and said, this is not going to happen, it was very awkward as she describes it, that she stopped kind of getting appearances in Washington programming, which she really wanted. She was doing sort of part-time or on a temporary basis. And ultimately, she complains. Mr. Shine again tells her to certainly call HR, file a complaint. She's a little loath to do it because, again, it's unimaginable, and I think this is kind of widespread, but unfortunately, a woman who goes to HR alleging sexual harassment, in her view, risks her future. But she filed her complaint, and suffice to say, a few weeks later, she was terminated. They used an out in her contract. They cited performance, but the question that I think remains for the network is Brian Wilson faces this allegation of harassment, goes on to get promoted. Her career gets stalled. He ends up leaving a couple years later under, sort of in a controversial way. So, after a complaint like that, what happens, right? And in a modern company, one hopes that it's investigated. And if there's a cultural issue, if there's a personnel problem, it's dealt with. It doesn't appear that happened. But again, Fox News has not kind of spoken about the process in much depth, though they're trying to show a willingness. So perhaps we'll see some answers to some of these questions when their internal investigation is complete.
Now, Roger Ailes denies all of this. He did resign a couple of weeks ago. Did he resign willingly, unwillingly? Is there any way to know whether his bosses pushed him out or in any way fired him?
Our reporting, and I have to credit the first report, again, this Gabe Sherman, who's been great on this story on Fox News, he wrote the book about them, but we confirmed it too. The reporting went that that he was told, basically, you have a limited time to either resign or we're going to have to force you out. Again, their feeling from the 21st Century Fox end of this was that the allegations were just too serious to be kind of swept away. They had to be dealt head on. And I guess even before their investigation was done, they had concluded that whatever his defense was, wasn't going to be good enough for them to get over their qualms.
Now, it seems that Roger Ailes has had some defenders at Fox, including some women at Fox. Greta Van Susteren, I believe, has defended him as well.
Greta Van Susteren initially defended him. She's since kind of done a follow-up defending her defense of him, just saying she had never seen that behavior from Roger Ailes, but it created a split within the network, especially among some of the women at the network there's a camp of those who, and Megyn Kelly is said to be one of them, who feel like before you can't step forward before you know the facts, because it scares, mid-level women. Like, it's easy for Megyn Kelly to speak with investigators. It's much harder for someone who's younger and more vulnerable in her career to step forward. And there was a sense among Megyn Kelly and others at the network that it was a disservice to the process. And what really angered people on that side of the debate was when one major talent at the network, Neil Cavuto, who's on Fox Business Channel as an anchor, but he's also a manager, said anyone who would make these allegations are sick. So there was a manager saying it's sick, which was viewed, I think, barely as quite chilling to anyone who was going to step forward, who, again, wasn't someone, a major star in her own right already.
Jim, any way to know viewer response? Have they lost viewers, gained viewers in response to what has been alleged at Fox?
No, they've had some record ratings as of, I think, even last week. I don't know if the ratings in front of me, but they've hit some highs. I mean, it's a hot election year, and their audience is committed. It cannot get certain views of the news in other places. The Fox provides sort of a singular harbor for people who want to, especially at night, who want to see more conservative views on the air. So no, it has not affected their ratings in the slightest.
Rupert Murdoch and his sons, right, his family have stepped in. Are they promising to address some of these concerns?
They say that, this is why they're doing that investigation. It will go wherever it leads. So really, one factor in this is that you have a younger generation of Murdochs coming in. Rupert Murdoch, is in his mid-80s. His sons, Lachlan and James, who are taking over the company from him, are in their kind of early 40s. And they have set the tone that we cannot have a corporate culture that applies by any of this. Now, Rupert Murdoch, we were told, is right there with them. I think, again, because the charges against Mr. Ailes were so serious that they had no choice. But I do think you have a new leadership coming in, and I don't know if that changes what Fox News looks like going forward very much. That's like kind of the huge question. But culturally, in terms of just the way it works as a corporation, I think we'll see more changes going forward. And another question is, will they share the results of their investigation? And I think they're going to have to some degree. And that will say a lot about the tone they're going to set, too.
And we're almost out of time here. Do you know when those results will be ready or be done, the survey or the study be done?
We got the sense a week or so ago that this investigation was, quote-unquote, winding down. The company has backed off of that in recent days. I think, again, as more people step forward and new questions arise, Ms. Loon's story, again, raising questions about the interim leadership, which we reported 2 days ago, meant they were expanding the investigation at least to the extent of understanding what the kind of management structure was doing around the alleged problems of Mr. Ailes. So I don't know. It could take time. And again, I'm not assuming it's a certainty that they will release the results. I assume they have to do something.
Well, Jim, we have to end our conversation there. Thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. That's Jim Rutenberg, media columnist for The New York Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. And we've been talking about allegations of sexual harassment, a hostile work environment at the Fox News Channel. And joining us now is Jane Hall, Associate Professor of Journalism and Media Studies in the School of Communication at American University in Washington, D.C. She was a panelist on Fox News Watch, a regular on Bill O'Reilly's show, and she wrote a piece recently in The New York Times. And Jane Hall, nice to have you with us on the show.
Thank you.
Nice to have you with us. Were you ever harassed in your years at Fox? Were you ever harassed by Roger Ailes?
No, I was not. As I write in the piece, I met him many years earlier as a journalist for the LA Times, covering the media, and I flew back and forth every Friday during the years that I was on Fox News Watch. I hesitated to write my piece, which was about the political culture and the connection to the misogyny that I saw on the air in terms of the way women were required to dress in that culture and the bullying, misogynist culture we see in Trump and in our political discourse. But I did not want to say that I had not been harassed because I did not know what other people had experienced, and I did not want to be out there, as Jim Rutenberg told you, And as I've read myself, there was a split and a push to women to come forward and defend Roger. And I think people probably regret that.
Let me quote something you said. I can say that I suspect there is a connection between the unspoken requirement for many women on Fox News and elsewhere in television to be leggy and beautiful and smart, and the bullying, misogynist political culture in which we find ourselves today. And it's possible to read that several ways. One is that when women are leggy and beautiful and smart, that they invite some kind of sexual harassment.
No, that is not what I said, and that is not what I believe. I said there was a requirement, an unspoken requirement. And if you've ever been on television, particularly on Fox, what I was trying to say and what I believe is that there has been a double standard in the most benign way in television. And on Fox, you had a culture where it's a power relationship. I mean, I think that's the connection. Again, Roger Ailes denies these charges of sexual harassment, although more and more people are coming forward. It's hard to continue to believe these, you know, anything other than this is true. The point I was trying to make was in commenting on the air, if you have a fully clothed older male anchor and a woman who is required to dress in a way that objectifies her, that is a power relationship. And I think this is a very difficult subject. You know, I was writing about what I saw on the air, and I do think there's a connection. I mean, I just think it's not an accident that Donald Trump is misogynist and bullying. I mean, there is a connection to the discourse in our culture that maligns women. And the only good thing I think has come out of this is that this is now evidence that even someone as powerful a mogul as Roger Ailes will be investigated. I mean, the problem is, in my mind, what's sickening is that there may have been a culture of enabling and silencing women. Certainly, you know, I mean, I interviewed Anita Hill here on campus. She's a great hero, in my opinion, and the young women here really got the fact that, you know, she stepped forward and was not believed. And if you have power over women in terms of their careers, that is a pretty sickening situation. If these stories are true of women feeling that they would have reprisals if they complained, I mean, that is really terrible.
Do you think what you described, and I think anyone that watches television knows exactly what you're talking about,
right,
Jane, the idea of sort of an older man in a suit and a younger, rather attractive woman sitting next to him, do you think that's unique to Fox, or do you think that's something about television news? There are some exceptions, of course, but that is a tableau that we would all recognize.
It is a tableau, and from, you know, we're all quoting Gabe Sherman, the New York Magazine writer, but I mean, he put in his book that Roger Ailes, you know, wanted translucent desks so that you could see women's legs. Now, I've written about women in television for many years, and I do think it's changing. I think Fox, you could put in quotes, perfected this. You know, I think Fox under Roger Ailes, you know, put this out there in a very strong cultural way that, interestingly, is only now beginning to be questioned. I mean, I think we're in a different moment, I hope, you know, where women will, I mean, you see it on the air. I mean, I don't think the women on CNN or Rachel Maddow on MSNBC feel they have to dress a certain way, but you know, there's been a double standard for many years. I just think Fox really, really pushed it with a culture that now I think we're seeing, you know, to my horror, may have been behind the scenes quite real in very disturbing ways.
You mentioned Donald Trump, and it's hard to get through an hour of an interview without mentioning Donald Trump. But since you said it, no. We're working on it. We haven't really been very successful on that. But nonetheless, we all know the comment that he made about his own daughter. If she were harassed, thinking that she should, or hopefully she would, move on to another company and another place. What does that tell us? And I think that's a belief that a lot of people have.
A belief that a lot of people have that women should quit?
Yeah, that women should move on.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, that was just another sign of his ignorance. And you know, the idea, first of all, that, you know, someone who is at her level of wealth could, you know, I suppose could conceivably quit. But the idea that women are supposed to quit, and then if they don't quit, which is what people, you know, whispered about Anita Hill, she must have been in love with Clarence Thomas because she was in touch with him. I mean, women, this is, women almost have not been able to get any kind of a fair shake on this, because the idea that a woman would need to leave a job because she was being harassed is absolutely blaming women for being harassed. I mean, that's, it's very hard to parse this in our culture, but I think it's getting easier. I mean, the idea that he said that, I mean, she hasn't said anything, but, you know, she was quoted in her book as saying that construction workers whistled at her until they realized she was the boss's daughter, and then they apologized. Well, what if she hadn't been the boss's daughter?
Mm. Jane, can you stay with us? We have another guest that's going to join us, and I'd like to mix it up with the two of you. Do you have a couple more minutes?
Sure.
All right. Jane Hall, Associate Professor of Journalism and Media Studies in the School of Communication at American University. That's in Washington, D.C., a former media commentator on the Fox News Channel. And joining us now is Joanna Grossman. She's the Ellen K. Solander Endowed Chair in Women and the Law, also Professor of Law at the Dedman School of Law at Southern Methodist University. And Joanna Grossman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And I know you were listening in as Jane Hall was talking about her reaction to what she observed what she observed at Fox. And I'd be curious about your response.
I think that what we're seeing with Fox is perhaps an extreme example of what's still going on all over the place. I don't think this particular scenario plays out in that many cultures, because it seems like a sort of unique setup. But harassment is everywhere, and there's no question.
Are you saying you don't think there's something unique to television because of there's such a focus on appearance, especially on women's appearances?
There's cultural differences in every kind of occupation and every kind of workplace, and what we find is that harassment manifests itself in different ways depending on that context. So yes, I do think there's something about television news where appearance is so important. But you could go to an asphalt paving crew and find harassment that would be just as damaging, you know, where appearance is not a priority. It would take a different form, right? There it might be more about trying to make women feel uncomfortable so they'll leave because it's a male occupation, as opposed to TV, where you sort of cultivate this, you know, hot young girl, you know, model. So it's not that it's better or worse. It's just different by context. And we know that from decades of studying how harassment happens.
Let me quote something that Kathleen Parker wrote, and this is about Fox, and she writes, "What is sexual harassment? When is a woman a victim, and when is she a participant? What is the statute of limitations on intimidation? What is the line between perception and interpretation? Is a woman still a heroine if she speaks up after she has tolerated it and professionally benefited while others are being targeted? When everyone knows what's going on and no one speaks up, isn't everyone complicit to some degree?" Jane, let me toss that back to you. What's your response to Kathleen Parker?
Well, that's complicated.
It is.
Again, I would say, I would say that as far as I can tell, there was a conspiracy of silence at Fox, and that is very damaging. I mean, anytime you have people signing secret million-dollar agreements, as this woman in the New York Magazine story did, you have silenced people. That does not mean that other people didn't know or were not responsible. But again, I think we have to be very, very careful not to seem in any way to blame the victim here. I think that is part of why we're so, frankly, confused in a way. I think to say everyone is to blame is to move this away from specifics of what actually happened, who knew in the Fox case, and were they listened to. I mean, that was what was so striking to me about Anita Hill. And my students relate this to sexual assault. You know, they immediately made that connection to sexual assault between sexual harassment, because that's a big issue on college campuses. I mean, the idea that that a woman should be believed and that something should happen. I mean, one thing that troubles me is, I frankly, if this is true, why was Roger Ailes walking away with a $40 million payout? Why could he not be fired for cause? That's what I don't quite understand. I mean, that's not exactly a big consequence if this is true.
Joanna, let me go back to you. And there are many reasons why a person would not speak up at work if they were being sexually harassed or felt that they worked in a hostile environment. What are some of those reasons?
I think the two most common reasons that people don't speak up are a fear of retaliation, right, that something will happen to them. And that's, in fact, a very well-founded fear. Studies of retaliation specifically show that as many as 50 to 60% of people who file a civil rights complaint do experience some kind of tangible consequence as a punishment for doing that. And we also have a lot of social psychology work showing that in a more general sense of the workplace, people really don't like complainers, even if what they're complaining about is real and illegal. There's a lot of social ostracism for being difficult, being a complainer. So fear of retaliation is a big reason. But as big a reason is futility. People just assume nothing will happen. And I think that's probably what you are seeing at Fox News, which is that the culture was so obviously tolerating this that a lot of people, maybe some people were afraid to speak up, but I'm sure a number of women thought, what's the point? They know, right? Obviously, Fox News knew what was happening. They paid out this one woman $3 million. So they knew what was happening. And if nobody was stepping in to stop it, then the message was, this is the culture. You can play or you can leave. And so this sort of sense of, well, why would I put myself forward if everyone I see is tolerating this, like I'm going to be the odd man out. And that's a very common sort of feeling, maybe even more extreme in this kind of culture.
Jane, let me give you a chance to respond to that. Then we're going to say goodbye to you about retaliation and futility. Does that describe the Fox culture that you knew?
You know, again, I did not know this part of the Fox culture. But I'm very struck by what you're saying, which is that it gets in, you know, it gets into the culture and people feel, well, no one's doing anything about it, and therefore they do not step forward. I think that's a pretty powerful. That sounds as if it must have been true, and probably is true in every workplace.
Jane, before we say goodbye, an email from Sharon. She says on CNN, Erin Burnett deliberately sits in a kind of desk with short skirts. I like Erin Burnett, but I find that upsetting.
Well, again, you know, I think what we have to do is not blame Erin Burnett. You know, she, I mean, that's where I think we have to really do some work. I mean, men have to be attractive on television too, and this is changing. But again, that's that what's in the culture, what's in the water that's unspoken until someone says, wait a minute, why are we doing this? Why do we have women doing this and the man is fully clothed? That's what I was trying to point out. But don't blame the woman for, you know, being behind a desk that the executives have designed. That's not her. That's not her doing.
Jane Hall, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Okay, thank you.
You're very welcome. We're going to stay with Joanna Grossman talking more about sexual harassment at the work. Place and also what the law tells us. And you can join the conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Joanna, perhaps you should put a definition on the table, because I think in many ways, even though the law has been in place for some time now, there is either confusion or not agreement or just kind of ignorance about what constitutes sexual harassment in the workplace.
So the standard legal definition has two kinds of harassment, right? There's one kind of harassment is called hostile environment harassment, and that's probably the more common one, although at Fox we're seeing a lot of different things. But hostile environment harassment is generally defined as unwelcome conduct of a sexual or sex-based, meaning targeted at women, nature that's severe or pervasive and which creates a hostile, offensive, or abusive working environment. Now, there are, in fact, a lot of pieces to that, which I'll explain in a second.
Sure.
The other type of harassment is maybe the more traditional or what people think of sometimes, which we used to call quid pro quo and sometimes still do. And that's the sort of sleep with me if you're fired, where somebody with power extracts or tries to extract a particular kind of sexual submission as a condition of keeping a job, getting a job, obtaining a benefit, avoiding a detriment, and so on. So I'm going to go back to hostile environment harassment a little
bit
because I think that's probably more common and what people have less of an understanding of. A big part of it is the unwelcome component, right? So did you want this to happen? And part of what you see at Fox News is you had asked earlier about, well, isn't everyone complicit? You had quoted someone saying, isn't everyone complicit in this? Kathleen Parker. And welcomeness and voluntariness are not the same thing. And the Supreme Court has made that clear actually 3 decades ago, that you might, in fact, go along with what you're being asked to do and with the exposure and with the conduct and yet not welcome it, right? And so unwelcomeness is the standard. So the fact that women are going along with this because they understand they have to survive in this environment is really irrelevant. The question is more, you know, is this an environment they wanted? And probably the answer for most of them would be no. They played along because they had to. The other thing is just how severe or pervasive it is. And that's what does in a lot of claims in court.
You know what, Joanne? Hold on to that thought only because we have to take a very short break and we will pick up on that. That's Joanna Grossman. She's the Ellen K. Solander Endowed Chair in Women and the Law, also Professor of Law at the Dedman School of Law at Southern Methodist University and an expert in sexual harassment law. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Got a bunch of comments coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. We're getting a refresher course in sexual harassment in the law from Joanna Grossman. Joanna, I had to jump on you right before the break there. Go ahead and finish your thought.
I was just talking about the two different kinds of sexual harassment, hostile environment and quid pro quo. And the one thing that's been clear since the mid-80s is both of those violate Title VII. They're both against the law. And there might be different consequences in terms of employer liability, what kind of responsibility the employer has. But there's no question that those are both actionable types of harassment. And both of them, it seems to me, were happening at Fox News.
Speaking of work environments, can we assume that most workplaces or a lot of them at least have some kind of policies on the books? Is that true? Not true?
It's definitely true. The big turning point in terms of the development of those internal structures were two Supreme Court cases in 1998 in which the court said, you know, not only are these two types of harassment illegal and forms of discrimination, but employers can be held liable. And depending on who's doing the harassing and what the harassment is, they have different levels of responsibility. But the one thing they said in those cases was employers need to take reasonable preventive and corrective efforts. So that spurred a whole human resources movement. It was a great boon for consultants all over the country who could go to their clients and say, you know, I need to help you with this. Mm-hmm. But what we did see is this incredible increase in the number of employers who had formal structures. So a formal policy saying harassment violates our company rules and here's what it is. And also internal procedures. So if it happens, here's what you should do about it.
And are those enforced? I mean, in many ways, talking about this sense of futility, if an employee feels like no matter what I do or if I go and say something, I might not be believed, or if I am believed, nothing particularly good is going to come out of this. How does a workplace enforce these policies and make someone feel comfortable and safe if they need to make a complaint?
So first of all, it's very hard to get good information on what's happening in the average workplace, right? The workplaces we get to autopsy are the ones where a case is brought and makes it up to a trial or an appellate level where we could really see what was going on. If you look just at those cases, you would say these policies aren't doing much and employers are not implementing them in a very effective manner. Now, the question is what's going on in all the other workplaces, right? Are there claims not being brought because their policies are effective? If you look at studies of anti-harassment measures, what you find is that there's no silver bullet. There's nothing that really changes the workforce. So a policy by itself does almost nothing. A policy plus training might have a slight effect on people's behavior. But what really matters is culture, and it has to be top down. So there are workplaces where everybody understands that that sort of behavior would not be accepted. And in fact, those workplaces seem to have less harassment. So we see correlations based on the type of culture in a workplace and the level of harassment. But the individual pieces have to be part of a broader effort and part of a broader tone in the workplace. The things themselves don't have any magic effect.
Let me read a couple of comments here. One from an anonymous man. That's what I'm reading here. Gretchen Carlson was fine working at Fox until her work was called into question. Then she pulls the sexual harassment card. What a classic case. Cut me a break. And this is, and we don't know, and perhaps this is part of the challenge with issues like this or allegations like this, which is, Joanna, it's hard. It is a classic he said, she said case. And in the case of Roger Ailes, he denies all of this.
So it is and it isn't, right? One of the things employers are supposed to be doing based on the rules of liability is conducting internal investigations when complaints are filed. Or even if a complaint isn't filed, if they have reason to know there might be a problem, they're supposed to be taking proactive efforts. Now, it seems to me at Fox News, it's not at all a he said, she said case, because Fox News itself had already settled complaints against this same person. So Fox News was on notice that there was a problem. And the fact that they didn't do something about it then, right, puts the blame on them, not on the people who continued to suffer. And sort of playing the sexual harassment card, I guess I don't think there is such a thing. What you see with people who experience sexual harassment is filing formal complaints or informal complaints is actually the least likely thing that they do, right? Most people who experience harassment in the workplace do nothing proactive about it. They deal with it, they quit, they drive themselves crazy, they get fat, they get skinny, they cry, they try to rearrange their desk to get away from it. But most people don't complain, right? So this perception that people are quick to jump and complain is just not at all supported by the empirical research.
Let me read another comment that speaks to what you just said. I was sexually harassed at my first internship, and people told me it would be best if I quit or moved on. How can we change the culture and help people if we tell women to not challenge their harassment? And obviously, if you're an intern, you are kind of low on the totem pole at a workplace.
Right. And I actually think the Trump comment about, you know, I would hope Ivanka would just quit has been great to start a discussion about this, because it's about attitudes and behavior. And if people don't talk about what you're supposed to do when you get harassed, then when it happens to you, you don't know what to do, right? And your instinct might be, well, this is sort of my problem and I need to deal with it. But that's not, the law doesn't support that. The law says it's the employer's problem. They're not supposed to let it happen. They're supposed to do something. So I think it's been great to start this national conversation about what is the appropriate response. But the idea that you should just quit and move on, people are told that all the time.
I'm sure.
Right? It's a very common type of advice, but it's ridiculous, right? If you think about the advice, right, it doesn't even make any sense. But given the culture we deal with, where the person who complains suffers the consequence as opposed to the person who might have committed the behavior, it's rational advice, right? It might, in fact, make sense. But we should not have a legal system or a social culture where we think that makes sense.
Eric Trump, the son of Donald Trump, said on Charlie Rose, I think what he's saying, referring to his father, is Ivanka is strong, a powerful woman. She wouldn't allow herself to be subjected to this, which I think also gets to some of this perception about someone who alleges or claims sexual harassment, that somehow it's her fault.
The power of the employee doesn't really make a lot of difference. If you look at both anecdotal things, but also research on harassment, we find harassment at all levels of the occupational spectrum, all levels within a particular employer. It's not about self-power, right? You don't sort of become a person who can't be harassed because you have such self-possession or such power or such income. That just isn't the way it works. It's situational. It's context-driven. It's about your particular relationship, perhaps, with you and the people above you or the people around you. But there's no immunity. So the fact that somebody has power might mean that they economically could survive, right? The harassment culture, like most discrimination culture, is hardest on low-income women and low-income victims who, in fact, can't afford to quit or can't, you know, don't have the resources to get themselves through a situation like this. So I think having power and money might make it easier to deal with the consequences, but it does not immunize you from the behavior.
I remember when, you know, Anita Hill testified doing so many programs about sexual harassment. Do you think we've lost sight of what it is, that it's an issue that's gone underground, that we don't take it seriously enough?
I think there's very much a problem of complacency. I think that, you know, in part, different issues have their moment, right? And the Anita Hill moment was a turning point that catalyzed people coming out, and everyone said, oh, wait a second, that happened to me, and you know, that happened to me, and that happened to my sister. And that went on for quite a while. But I think since the Supreme Court really stepped up, and they did so in a very important and good way, in a series of five or six cases where they came across and said, this is all illegal, and the employers are responsible, and this is, you know, we need to do something about this. And then I think after that, after 1998, there hasn't been another case. And I think people have just stopped talking about it and other things have taken center stage. But I think there is a sort of complacency in the workplace that as long as you have a policy and procedure, that's good enough, that there's not really anything else you need to do. And the truth is, we don't, the data we have suggests that the level of harassment is more or less the same as it was before everybody had a policy and procedure. So, like I said, I like that in some ways Trump has made these comments and that this Fox News scandal happened because it is forcing this national conversation.
Well, let's have a conversation with Mary calling us from Galloway, New Jersey. And Mary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I just wanted to say it's an interesting topic. I have to disagree with the guest. I think for many women, if you're harassed at work, the only option you do have is to go look for another job, because taking on that with a company is not always an option financially for so many of us.
There's no question about that, Mary. Hold on the line. Let me give Joanna just a chance to respond to your comments. And she's saying many women just don't feel empowered to be able to take this on.
Oh, I don't disagree with that at all. In fact, I think that is the reality. And if you look at how victims respond to harassment, that is a very common response for exactly the reasons you cite. So I don't think you're disagreeing with me at all. My point is simply that that shouldn't be the culture, right? We should not expect that that's an appropriate response. We should have things in place to protect women from having to make that choice. But I don't at all disagree descriptively that that's in fact what many women are forced to do, that taking on the machine is not an option. Yeah. I absolutely agree with you. I just want the aspiration, right, to be higher than that.
Mary, is this something you personally experienced?
And I'm not a Trump supporter in any way, shape, or form, but I actually think he has been getting a raw deal on this issue. Like, the media has been so critical of his response, and I've thought to myself, I would advise my daughter the same thing.
But what's interesting, Mary, because you say two interesting things. One is that many women or many people who are victimized by this don't feel like they have the power to do this. And I think the point that if there was a criticism of Donald Trump, which is that this is a wealthy family with lots of connections, and it's probably a lot easier for them to move on and find another job than, you know, regular folks like you and me. But let me give Joanna a chance to respond. And Mary, I appreciate your call to Radio Times. Joanna, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I sort of agree. Like, I agree it's a rational response. I just don't like that, right? I'm trying to help change the world so that people do have options. I mean, the law, which does ban harassment and does impose liability on employers, should be activated in a way that isn't a rational response. Right now, it is. I have no disagreement with that. I just hope for better. And I think what I didn't like about his comment was not that it was an irrational type of advice, but that he seemed perfectly happy with that. That, you know, that's a good response, right? I just want it to be better.
Mary, thanks for the call. Let me get Albert from Delaware to join us. Hi, Albert. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My call. Enjoy the show. I'm in total agreement with everything that's being said, but I'm looking at it from a male's point of view. I actually was in a job situation where I was accused of something that ended up being false, but it was, you know, I was still uncomfortable in that job situation and ended up leaving anyway. Is there any comments or advice on that?
Sure. It's a good question, Albert. And I'm sure, Joanna, there are, if not false accusations, misunderstandings about things. How does the law deal with that?
So there, well, first of all, in terms of data, what we would find is there's a pretty small percentage of false accusations. It's hard for us to ever say something's false, right, when we study things. But we could say there's certainly accusations that are unsubstantiated, and probably some of those are, in fact, false or fabricated. You're talking about a 1 or 2% number. But that doesn't mean for the person who experiences it that isn't an awful experience that might have the same kinds of consequences, right, as the victims we're talking about. In a perfect world, these internal procedures that employers have adopted, they would figure that out, right? They're supposed to be fact finders. They're supposed to hear the allegations. They're supposed to do an investigation. They're supposed to talk to the person accused. They're supposed to figure out what happened and make a determination, including making credibility determinations. The problem is, and this affects a person that Albert describes as much as a victim who's not believed, is that these internal investigations are generally not very good, right? Most employers are not very good at being jury, judge, and sentencer, right? They just don't have the tools to conduct adequate fact-finding investigations. So I have no doubt that there are some people who are falsely accused where the process does not smoke that out appropriately, just as there are people who make accusations that are true and the employer finds that they can't substantiate them. I don't know how to fix that problem, but I certainly understand that it's there.
We're almost out of time here. Do you see this as a teachable moment or a teachable moment that might just disappear into the ether?
Well, in this day and age, everything disappears.
It does feel that way, doesn't it?
We have our cycle. This has had more attention and more staying power than I would have expected. And I think the Fox News situation is going to end up being more of a memorable part of the teachable moment than Trump's comment, although there's some overlapping points. But I do think they've been great in terms of getting this issue back into the conversation. And I think the Fox News scandal, the more that comes out, the worse the facts are, the worse the history. It really brings home this point that I'm always sort of hammering on, which is that institutional knowledge is very important, that they knew what was going on. It's the institution's fault. It's not the women's fault. It's the institution's fault.
We have to end on that note. Joanna Grossman, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Professor of Law at the Dedman School of Law at Southern Methodist University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for a newsletter, and listen to us on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.